Willie Nelson is one of the superstars of country music, and he reached that status with songs, a vocal style, and an image that broke the Nashville mold. Willie Nelson is best known for his recordings of Always On My Mind, Let It Be Me, and On the Road Again, which crossed over to the top 20 on the pop charts. But many of his songs were famous before he was. Back in the late 50s and early 60s, other singers had hits with Crazy, Funny How Time Slips Away, and Nightlife. Nelson had to make a living through odd jobs like selling vacuum cleaners and encyclopedias door-to-door, working as a radio DJ and teaching Sunday school. Now his successes include 5 Grammys and 8 Country Music Association awards. 23 of his records have gone gold or platinum. He's also starred in the films Barbarossa, Songwriter, and Honeysuckle Rose. Willie Nelson chronicled his life in his autobiography, Willie. His latest record is an album of standards called What a Wonderful World. Before we meet him, let me play you an excerpt from it. This is Moon River. Willie Nelson from his new album, What a Wonderful World. Willie Nelson, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Since you've written an autobiography, let's go back to your early childhood when you were growing up in Texas, and most of the people around you were picking cotton, and I think you worked in the cotton fields when you were young. You knew you didn't want to do that as an adult. Did that help motivate you to write songs and to sing and become a performer?
Well, definitely, I knew early in life that I didn't want to be a professional cotton picker. I knew music had to be better. I would work on the side of the highway there in Abbott and see these air-conditioned Cadillacs driving by. And for a 10-year-old kid, it gave me a way to go there. I said, well, these guys must know something I don't know.
Were you exposed to a lot of different music of people singing, from people singing in the cotton fields?
Yeah, there was a lot of black singers in those days and picking cotton and... sometimes it wouldn't be unusual for be 25, 30, 40 pickers in the field. And, of course, they would sing those old great old blues songs, and they would write them on the spot. It sounded like one would do a verse or a line from across the field, and someone would answer him from across the field on the other side. And sort of like having your own opera there in the cotton fields.
Your grandfather died when you were young, and your parents divorced when you were young. By the time you were age 7, you said you were writing cheating songs after your parents divorced. And you said that you were writing these cheating songs before they could actually be sung in Texas. What kind of unspoken rules were there where you were about what songs were okay to sing?
We could sing any kind of songs we wanted to. It was a little bit, I think, different for a kid of 9 and 10 years old to be writing and singing cheating songs. Obviously, I hadn't done a lot of running around on anybody at that age. But, of course, if you believe in reincarnation... then there's possible that I'm writing about some other time.
And you do believe in reincarnation?
Yes.
You said that when you were young, you saw Hank Williams' songbook, the Johnny Mercer songbook, the Hoagy Carmichael songbook. So by the time you were 8, you thought you should have one of those songbooks of your own. What were your songs like then, the ones that you compiled when you were 8 years old and into the Willie Nelson songbook?
Well, of course, back then I thought they were fantastic. Today, looking back on them, they're not really. I don't think there's probably not a Stardust among them. But
do you remember them all?
I remember them. Yes.
When you were young and getting started, you played a lot of barrooms, and you played through a lot of barroom brawls, through stabbings and shootings. What was your technique when all hell would break loose? Would you duck or just keep playing?
Just keep playing longer and louder. And I remember one time in Dallas, it hadn't really been that long ago, that we had just started, the music had just started, about 10 o'clock at night, and we just started playing Whiskey River, and the fight broke out. So I said, well, we'll just play until they quit fighting. And we played and played, and they fought and fought, and we played and played, and they fought, and here come the police. So I finally said, wait a minute, this show is over. So we broke down and got out.
Did that teach you not to be fazed by an audience, no matter how they respond?
Sort of, yeah. I think I've seen all kinds of audiences. Naturally, the ones who sit and quietly and listen to what we're doing, or the ones who get up and dance and have a good time, are the ones I like better.
Willie Nelson is my guest, if you're just joining us. You established yourself as a songwriter before your reputation spread as a singer. And in your early days as a songwriter, you were royally ripped off. I don't know whether you think of it that way or not, but for instance, your song Nightlife, you sold that for $150. And it went on to be recorded by around 70 artists. It sold 30 million records over the years. How did it come to be that you sold that song for $150?
I also sold another song, Family Bible, that along during the same period of time. I was in Houston, and I was married, had my kids there, and we were looking for a place to stay, and I needed some rent money. When I first hit Houston, I stopped by a club called the Esquire Club, and it was on a Monday afternoon. And there was a band rehearsing in there. And I said, well, maybe I can apply for a job here or sell some songs or something. So I introduced myself to the band leader, a guy named Larry Butler, and told him that I was a guitar player and songwriter, and asked him if he had a job open in his band. And he said, no, I didn't. So I said, well, you're looking for any songs? And he said, well, I don't know. He was recording at the time. And so I started singing him songs, and he said, well, those are pretty good songs. What do you want me to do, record them or what? I said, no, I want to sell them to you. I'll sell them to you for $10 a piece. And I'd done him 8 or 10 songs, and he said, no, he said, I'm not going to buy those songs from you because they're too good of songs to sell for $10 a piece. But he said, I will loan you some money. So he let me have $50, and that was enough to put my family in get us an apartment for the week and buy a few groceries. And I never did forget that man. He's still a good friend of mine. I still see him quite often, him and his wife, Pat, and we still talk about that, he didn't buy those songs. He missed out on a good deal.
So who did buy Nightlife, and what's the story behind that?
Nightlife I sold, actually for $100, I sold it to friends of mine, Claude Gray, Paul Buskirk, and Walt Breland, and it took all three of them to come up with $100, and those are the same guys I sold Family Bible to. So it kind of stayed in the family.
Did you get a songwriting credit, or did they buy that from you as well?
In the beginning, I didn't get the credit. Later on, a few years later, I started getting credit for it. I started getting my name back on the record.
You used the money that you got from Nightlife to fund yourself to go into the studio and record the same song. What happened to your recording of it?
Oh, it wound up, probably didn't sell 4 copies. It was, I thought, a pretty good recording back in those days. Paul Buskirk was in the band. Herb Remington, one of the finest steel guitar players alive, used to work with Bob Wills. He was living in Houston at the time, and I had some of the best musicians in town. We did the record, and it turned out well, but it just was one of those small labels, and it didn't sell.
As you became a little more established as a songwriter, did you still get cheated out of songwriting credits or royalties, or did you learn how to avoid that from keep that from happening?
Well, fortunately, when I got to Nashville, I met some people. Hank Cochran was one, and Hal Smith of Pamper Music in Nashville and Goodlettsville. And I started writing for Pamper Music. And it was a good publishing company. Their accounting was honest, so I lucked out there. A lot of writers haven't been that fortunate, but I lucked out and got hooked up with a good, honest organization to begin with.
You went to Nashville in 1960, and when you got there, Patsy Cline recorded your song Crazy, and I think that was the first hit you had after moving to Nashville, a hit by Patsy Cline. You recorded the song yourself, and I want to play your recording of it. But first, I'd like to know if there's a story behind the writing of the song.
Well, it was one of those songs that I wrote while I was living in Houston, just before I went to Nashville, and I was playing the Esquire Club and living over in Pasadena and driving all the way over to the Hempstead Highway every night. And I did a lot of my writing during the traveling back and forth, and Crazy was one of the songs that I wrote back during that time.
Let's listen to it, written and sung by my guest Willie Nelson.
Crazy, crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy, crazy for feeling so blue. I knew that you'd love me as long as you wanted. And then someday you'd leave me for somebody new.
Do you remember what year you recorded that?
Yeah, that was that particular recording was about 1971.
It seems to me that you hold your notes longer now when you sing, that there's more sustain in your singing.
I think my lungs are stronger now. I was a heavy smoker back in those days and wasn't really in that good a condition. And that has a definite, you know, it matters a lot in your singing if your lungs can't hold air.
When you first went to Nashville, and I think it was 1960, you describe in your book how you really didn't have much money, so you brought a siphon with you so you could siphon off some gas for the trip.
Well, we call that the Oklahoma credit card. It used to be used quite often back in those days.
Well, Nashville really wasn't ready for your performing. They were ready for your songwriting. You did pretty well as a songwriter. But it was very hard for you to get started as a singer. You describe even how your singing has always been behind the beat, and in Nashville people thought you'd lost a sense of rhythm, that you didn't know how to carry the beat.
Only the people who didn't know music.
Mm-hmm.
The ones who knew music and could count knew that I wasn't breaking meter. The musicians, the good musicians who I played with knew that I wasn't breaking meter, that it was just phrasing. Sinatra had been doing that kind of thing for a long time. It was just a little unusual to hear a guy who's supposed to be a country singer doing that. But I had listened to Frank Sinatra and all those guys all my life, and I admired their ability to phrase, and I tried a little bit of it myself on country songs, and it was a little bit different. And the guys in Nashville had just never heard it that much.
And what was different about the songs that you were writing compared to what was on the country charts in the early 60s when you were in Nashville?
Well, they weren't what they would, Nashville really wanted to call commercial songs. What they call commercial, of course, I was always afraid of that word, and got to the point where I hated the sound of the word commercial because they always used it at the wrong time. They always said, well, you know, that's a great song, but it's not commercial. And they said it about Crazy. They said it about several songs that I had written. I knew they were wrong, but it's hard to fight City Hall sometimes.
Well, just to give a sense of what pop music was like then, you describe how on top of the charts was Pat Boone's Love Letters and Debbie Reynolds' Tammy. Were you, did you see a way for yourself to fit in?
Well, of course, my heroes were guys like Ernest Tubb and Roy Acuff and these guys who had been on the Grand Ole Opry for a long time. Bob Wills, Lefty Frizzell, Hank Williams. I saw myself, I thought, being able to do what they were doing. And that's really all I was looking for, is just to, you know, get some exposure and be able to get a record out where I could play and work.
One of your friends in your book comments that in the late 60s and early 70s, it was very difficult to book you into clubs because a lot of people were intimidated or even afraid of you, partly because of the way you looked, long hair, an earring in one ear. Did that seem like a problem to you? Did you feel like your looks were alienating people who might otherwise have been booking you?
Well, when I first started letting my hair grow, I didn't really worry about whether it was going to offend anybody or not, because I had been doing what I thought the establishment had been telling me the right way to do things for a long time, and what they were telling me just wasn't working. You can't go around all the time doing what everybody tells you to do. So I decided it was time for me to start looking after my own future a little bit. And I had noticed, playing a lot of the clubs in Texas, that there was some young people that had sort of filtered their way into those redneck beer joints, and I noticed their hair was long, and they were trying to hide their hair under their coats, and yet they'd get out and dance San Antonio Rose and Fraulein. And this was right in the middle of the rock and roll area, and I said, well, wait a minute, there's something happening here. Maybe the kids are liking country music for a change. And then I went to a place called Armadillo World Headquarters there in Austin, and run into a lot of good country music by young people. And so I said, well, here's an audience that I'm not getting to, and maybe I should. And I played the Armadillo World Headquarters. It was so good that I called Waylon. I said, Waylon, come on down. There's something you should see down here. And there was. There was just great enthusiasm for country music coming from the young people. And that's one of the things that started things turning around for me.
Well, you mentioned Waylon Jennings and your performances together. You became known as the Outlaws. There was an album that you both appeared on that had that name as well. Did you think of that whole concept of the Outlaws as being something that was finally packaged by the country music executive? Something, an idea that you had started, but a package that they found a name for?
Well, I was really sort of proud of the fact that we wasn't really going along with the way that other people who didn't know us were saying that we should do our music. Mm-hmm. And if they wanted to call that a rebellion, then it was. If they wanted to say that we were outlaws because we didn't, well, that's a good enough name. You know, I like Jesse James. They were colorful characters. We weren't robbing any banks or killing anybody, but if calling us outlaws was a way to get us out there and get us our music exposed, I wouldn't have any objections to it at all.
Another one of your breakthroughs was a 1975 album called Redheaded Stranger. And I want to play one of your songs from that record, Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain. What was different from the sound of this album, the way you were produced, the way you sang, your choice of material, from previous albums that that felt perhaps more like what you wanted to be doing?
Well, it's easy to see once you play the record that this is definitely a very underproduced song. There's just a very few musicians on there compared to Moon River that we heard a few moments ago, which has a whole studio full of musicians and voices on it. But the fact that it was a country song, I felt like it should have been treated that way, and it didn't require, it didn't call for all those big arrangements. So that's why it came out the way it did. A lot of people, even the record company, said, wait a minute, might be a good demo, but it's not, you know, I don't think it's going to be something you'd want to release as an album. And I tried to convince them that, yes, this is something I want to release as an album.
So you had to fight to do it?
Every step of the way.
Well, let's hear Redheaded Stranger. I'm sorry, from the album Redheaded Stranger. Let's hear Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain.
In twilight, flow I see. Blue eyes crying in the rain. When we kissed goodbye and parted, I knew we'd never meet again. Love is like a dying ember, and only memories remain. And through the ages I'll remember crying in the rain.
That's really beautiful. Did you feel like you could sing more freely too with less accompaniment behind you, that your voice could cut through better?
Well, yeah, I still think that the simple arrangements are really the best. I want to do an album one day with just the voice and guitar. I think some other guys have done that in the past few years and been successful at it. And I really don't know whether to be successful or not, or be commercial again, as they say, but it's something that I want to do.
In the past few years, you've been recording a lot of standards, pop standards. And here's what I'm wondering about that. You describe how when you were young, you were very... you never wanted to be called a sissy, and you learned how to fight when you were really young. You learned how to be really tough. And I think to a lot of guys who are very self-conscious about that when they're young, that some of the pop songs are considered not quite manly enough. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Maybe this was different when you were growing up, but certainly after the era of rock and roll, to like Hoagy Carmichael wasn't necessarily something you'd confess to, I think, if you wanted to be like real macho. Did that ever give you pause?
No, it was never a problem for me, because when I was playing the clubs back in Texas, no one come up and said, well, I want you to do this pop standard, Stardust, for me. They would come up and say, "Can you, do you know Stardust, or do you know Harbor Lights, or do you know San Antonio Rose, mm-hmm. or you know Fraulein, or Milk Cow Blues?" The labels weren't in those people's minds. They were just asking for music.
A lot of the songs that you sing, both the songs that you choose to sing by others and the songs that you sing of your own, are so frequently about being vulnerable, about being rejected. Reading your autobiography, it seems like so many times it's been you who've ended up walking out on someone and who's kind of given up on marriage because you're always on the road. Yeah, do you know what I mean? Your life somehow reads different to me than the songs that you read.
Well, it's gone both ways. There's been times when I've been left also, and since some times when I've left. But as they say, that's what makes the jukebox play.
Are you still writing a lot of songs?
I'm still writing. I'm not writing a lot of songs. I never did write a lot of songs. It used to be if I wrote 8 or 10 songs a year, that was a big year for me. Now I maybe write 4 or 5 songs.
Are you singing more standards now because they're songs you enjoy singing, or because you're writing fewer songs?
Well, both. I have put out probably 40, 50 albums, I guess, of original material, and that definitely eats up the material. So if I only did my own songs, there'd be a lot of quiet albums. By now I would have run out. I've got some songs that I've written that I haven't recorded, but at this stage of my career, it seems like that the standards, which are selling well in both markets, are being more in demand by the record company, because they can get a lot of sales out of it, guaranteed, they feel, where if I handed them an album of my own original things at this point, they might say, well, you know, that's fine, Willie, but that probably won't sell over 150,000. We want something that'll sell 1 million. So, and especially since they're giving me all that money, I guess they have a right to say what they want.
Sure, I guess at this point, unless you're triple platinum, you're something of a failure compared to previous records.
Yeah, and it's really sort of a dilemma. Right now, I'm in the process of trying to figure out some way to put out these albums. The other albums, maybe a special products or something, where I can do the albums that I want to do without having to worry about putting out a pop standard album, every time.
It seems to me from your autobiography that you've become much more conscious of your health in the past few years. You had a lung collapse in around 1981, And it sounds like you gave up, went into a rehab clinic, gave up drugs and maybe alcohol as well.
Well, let me put it this way. I believe in moderation, and
which isn't the way you live most of your life.
It wasn't the way I lived, no, but now I believe in it a lot more than I did back then.
Yeah, you describe how you had to give up tripping on stage, because you were once tripping on stage and felt like your fingers were turning into claws on the banjo, and that you felt like you looked like a werewolf.
Mm-hmm, and people's heads were swelling.
Had you tripped a lot while performing, or did you give that up pretty early because it was so hard to keep the music together?
Well, yeah, it didn't take but one time to realize that's not the way to do a show. It didn't take a genius to figure that one out.
Being of superstar status now, do you feel lucky that came later in life after you'd done a lot of work and that you'd be better able to handle it?
Absolutely. I've always said that if I'd have gotten this successful back in those early years, I wouldn't have kept it. I would have thrown it away. So it's a blessing that it came later in life.